Okay, good afternoon and welcome back after the week of reading that hopefully everybody's participated in, or indeed the final few days of putting together your first critique exercise, which is wonderful. Just a little aspect with respect to the critique. Remember, it's a critique, not an essay. If any of you are still having one or two challenges with the exercise, well, I think I've seen most of folk who've actually contacted me via email or see me in person, then you've still got a few hours to run a final piece past me. But don't panic, it all will work out perfectly in the end. Or maybe it won't. Anyway, focus of today is really the next phase of reporting continuity and change that I want to cover in this module, which, as you can see, takes us very much into the 20th century with that wonderful driver called sport. And what I'll be doing today is focusing on this subject that tends to polarise people, despite the fact that it features prominently in the pages of newspapers and been broadcast into the homes of British people on a regular basis as part and parcel of our national culture, our existence, and more. And one of the key things I'll be looking at is to examine how commercial sport effectively grew during the early years of the 20th century. How it became this behemoth that we see today, with million-dollar deals and million-pound deals seemingly becoming the norm, whether it's Formula One, whether it's tennis, whether it's cricket, whether it's football, and so on. I'll also be looking to demonstrate why sports news became important to a vast number of people who weren't actually intrinsically interested in sport itself, but they were thirsty for sports news in order to pursue their love of gambling. We'll also see how a significant number of these people were actually women. I then want to spend some time moving on to the fourth point of the actual session, which is the whole notion of how sports journalists play an increasingly important part in the construction of sporting heroes. And also we'll explore why sporting heroes were important and why, to a major extent, they already still are important. We've already talked about this in a couple of seminars. We'll go on to talk about that as well later. And in the later part of the lecture, I'm going to turn the attention to the development of broadcast sports journalism, a field some of you might end up actually working in, and also address the issue of how broadcast sports journalism has altered the reporting of sport and how it's actually transformed sport itself in a whole range of ways. Finally, we'll consider the whole growth of the popular fanzine, the popular website, more or less as a reaction against the mass media coverage of sport, and almost as a way in which fans themselves can reclaim back their own interests, their own particular beliefs, and their own elements relating to sport and so on. So let's start off with the second key point there, this growth of commercial sport and the extent of sports coverage. Well, from the final decades of the 19th century, commercial sport in Britain was expanding rapidly. The Football League was founded in 1885, and in order for commercial sport to prosper, at least initially, gate receipts were of key importance. In other words, the money and the income that was generated into the sport was generated by people paying to watch the game, to watch the event at the gate. It's important to consider that not only individuals have the opportunity to attend such sporting events in their leisure time, but also those moments of leisure time were also shared by large numbers of workers simultaneously. It's pointless having a sporting event if nobody can actually attend, even though behind closed doors is something which occasionally is used as a means of censoring football clubs these days. Ultimately, the sport needs its spectators as much as the spectators need the sport. By the end of the 19th century, in most trades, the concept of the Saturday half-day closing or half-holiday had actually become a known fact. Saturday afternoons became the favoured moment when key sporting contests would actually take place. Sundays remained out of bounds for most commercial sporting events, primarily owing to church opposition. In fact, that remained in place until the 1980s, and the Football Association's Rule 25, that matches should not be played on a Sunday, was only finally lifted in 1981. Throughout the 20th century, the working class were clearly deciding upon the opportunity of how to actually spend time in their leisure hours. By 1900, to actually go through some of the numbers, the hours of work averaged per week were 54, which works out at about 11 hours a day on a 5.5-day working week. By 1938, those hours had shifted to about 46.5 hours per week. So clearly there were more hours available with which to actually fill your time and go and see things or occupy yourselves and so on. As well as free time increasing for those in work, opportunities and time to pursue sporting interests also expanded, not only because of increasing leisure time, but also because of a reduction in family size. In 1914, the average working class family would devote 60% of its income to food. By 1938, that had fallen to 35%. Not that their children were being ill-fed or ill-treated and so on, but basically there were fewer of them. Fewer mouths to feed, more disposable income. Now, professional football had already proved itself as a crowd puller by the early years of the 20th century. And by the mid-1890s, the Football League was firmly established. It extended from 12 to 16 clubs and attracted about 2 million spectators during the 1905-1906 season. It actually totaled in that year over 6 million regular attendees per year. The first Wembley FA Cup final in 1923 attracted a crowd that was estimated at 250,000, which was twice as much as Wembley had originally been built for. Obviously, challenges with respect to tickets and gate receipts, known as the White Horse Final. But again, that whole notion of over 1,000 people needing hospital treatment thereafter, one thing that couldn't be denied was the sheer popularity of football as a mass spectator sport. And unsurprisingly, perhaps, the newspaper-buying public spent large and increasing sums of money on newspapers that devoted a large and sometimes growing amount of space to sports coverage. During the late 1930s, the Times would devote about 20% of its space to sport. So a fifth of the Times would actually be given to sporting coverage. The Daily Mail and the Daily Mirror would regularly dedicate about 38% to sport of their particular coverage. So over a third in both those instances. Indeed, by the 1970s, the Daily Mirror was devoting over half of its news space to covering sport. The only reason newspapers were doing this was because they were looking to fulfil what their readers were looking for, to focus very much on those key areas. It's like any hobby. You get interested in it, you get into it, you want to follow it more often, find out more details, and so on. At first, football was covered predominantly in the more specialist newspapers of the 19th century, such as the Athletic News. This was published on a weekly basis from Manchester in the 1880s, as well as the Saturday night specials that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago when talking about the provincial press and so on. But the technology that actually meant that match results and reports were almost instantly available via the telegraph, the telephone and so on, also meant that sports coverage soon began to extend into the daily national press. Sports coverage in the Nationals did vary in terms of which sports were actually covered. The Times gave most prominence to cricket and initially paid little attention to football. It noted that the FA Cup final, seen up there, was of little interest except to the lower working classes. That was something which remained in the Times for a considerable period of time. possibly inconceivable in today's Rupert Murdoch News International owned Times Media. However, the popular daily press in the first decade of the 20th century were to give a prominent place to sport. And it was during this period, the first 10 to 15 years of the 20th century, that the sports page at the back of the newspaper began to appear. Richard Holt, a historian and key writer of the Times, noted that the emphasis remained on results and reports rather than background gossip and speculation. Such sports reporting fuels the conversations of working class youths, who were the subject, again, of anxiety, determining the first part of the 20th century. What do we do with respect to the working class young men? How do we occupy their time? How do we give them something to do, etc.? And again, as Holt writes, the fortunes of the Surrey team are followed with that breathless and extravagant interest which demands a copy of every edition of the Star. Not the Daily Star that we now appreciate has a different connection with respect to sport. In Birmingham, the evening papers were eagerly read each night, and boys who never played the game themselves were all able to name at any time the role played by prominent local sports people and footballing celebrities. Now, there's much impressionistic evidence that suggests, in the main, when we're talking about the sport and the press and so on, sports coverage was actually the essential reading of most newspapers for many male readers. Even if the readers themselves were not keen sports participants. So people would read about sport without necessarily being sporting participants themselves. Why was this seen as important? Well, basically to give people something to talk about. So they would be able to actually talk about the latest players, the latest results and so on. And then when we reach the 1920s, with sports reporting and photography becoming an essential and crucial part of every popular newspaper, sports coverage becomes so extensive that the old specialist newspapers such as the Athletic News would disappear as independent sports newspapers, leaving the way open for the Nationals to really have the main sports coverage. The other key thing that we see beginning to impact in terms of the relationship between the press or print journalism and sport is a form of journalism that we can relate to as American journalism and American writing. Because American journalism also begins to influence the way in which the popular press reports sports stories. Verbose, late Victorian style commentary, which referred to hapless custodians and leather spheroids and other long-winded phrases, would go out, and in came a much more gee-whiz style of reporting, which was more colourful, which was snazzy, it was gossipy, it was friendly, it was a different kind of sports reporting. Dressing room chat and speculation began to feature prominently in expanding sports pages, especially in the Sunday titles such as The People. In 1924, the Sunday People boasted 4 pages of sport and sold 600,000 copies. By 1946, its circulation had risen to 4.6 million. And by 1950, more than a third of its pages were devoted to sport, especially football. In the 1960s, the People also sponsored a year-long investigation into a gambling ring, which sought to fix football results. And popular titles such as The People and The News of the World began to employ investigative sports reporters. People such as Alan Hobie, self-styled Man Who Knows. And again, that whole notion of how match reporting was developed and working into this whole coverage of literally the worlds of sport was a key element to deal with the sports coverage in the first half of the 20th century. So let's move on to the next little phase here, section 3 in terms of this coverage, sport, gambling and the press. Although most betting off course, or off the events of the horse racing area and horse racing worlds, known as off-course betting, was actually illegal until 1960, gambling was exceptionally widespread in Britain. When have we not been attracted to making a fast buck or to actually having a little wager on a horse coming in first, second or third, an each way bet, or indeed a wager on sporting results? However, because gambling was actually illegal, unless you were actually at the course itself and betting at the course or at the event, it's difficult to measure its extent other than through anecdotal evidence. However, it's been suggested that by the early 1930s, between £300 and £400 million were spent on betting each year. To put this in context, it's worth noting that in 1950, only £9 million was spent actually spectating in Britain. In 1950, you spend £9 million on gate receipts and tickets. A decade earlier, you're spending £300 to £400 million on betting. By the 1920s, it was also estimated that there were about 4 million regular bettors or gamblers in Britain. Many more, of course, had a flutter on particular races, such as the Derby, the St. Ledger, and the Grand National. In the first two decades of the 20th century, the majority of punters would concentrate on the horses. From the 1920s, however, betting on dog racing and also football increased substantially in importance, particularly with the advent of the football pools. And what do you actually need if you are an intelligent, quote-unquote, gambler? You need information. And to make an intelligent bet on a horse race, each gambler had to have a minimum amount of information. Things such as the age of the horse, the weight of the horse, who its sire was, who its owner was, how much money it had won previously, what was its form, who was the jockey, what was the handicap. Whole stack of information, all of which might impact your decision on whether or not to make a bet on a particular horse in a particular race. And so sporting press, which actually supplied that information, would have a huge readership. And by the end of the 19th century, the Sporting Life, the Sportsman, and the Sporting Chronicle all had circulations in excess of 300,000 copies per week. The lunchtime editions of local newspapers were also vital sources of racing information. So much so that, according once again to Richard Holt, many public libraries would actually paste out the racing news before allowing the public to read those newspapers. Again, newspaper owners and newspapers themselves wrestled with their consciences about whether or not to publish betting information. Was this likely to impact and create a nation of gamblers? Was this likely to produce something where people would be more likely to have a bet when they couldn't really afford to? And actually, it would put them into financial difficulties if they lost. But most newspapers eventually did publish information for fear of otherwise losing sales. In the interwar period between 1918 and 1938, for the first time, the Manchester Evening News carried betting information. And that was particularly significant because it had been seen primarily as an anti-gambling newspaper under the editorship of non-conformist Russell Allen. So again, change of editor, change of style, change of approach. Let's print the gambling information and the heck with it. It doesn't really matter if people are silly enough to waste their money on the horses. That's okay, as long as they're buying our newspapers. The Labour-lined Daily Herald also had its own racing service. And even the communist paper The Daily Worker, which had ostracised gambling as a gigantic swindle perpetrated on the masses, eventually saw the sales value in publishing starting race odds and tips. In the early years of the century, there were distinctions, therefore, between the respectable press, which didn't cover betting information, and the unrespectable, which did. So you had a line where the Manchester Evening News would have a sense of superiority for a time over the Manchester Evening Chronicle, which would actually cover betting news and information extensively. And this relationship between newspapers and betting became stronger still during the 1930s, with the emergence of the football pools on a national scale, whether it be Littlewood's, whether it be Vernon's, simply selecting 8 score draws out of a fixture list on a Saturday could make you a half millionaire, quarter millionaire, etc. Again, the temptation for easy money was inevitably there. In the interwar years, once again, between 1918 and 1938, about 10 million people would fill in pools coupons on a weekly basis. And many of those 10 million folk would be women who had no intrinsic interest whatsoever in football itself, but actually wanted to hopefully, you know, win the equivalent of the lottery and so on. Let's move on to the fourth point. Again, a critical element in this symbiotic, beneficial relationship between sport, journalism, and the wider community of the 20th century, the construction of heroes. Whilst gambling would attract many readers to the sports pages of newspapers, where they obtained vast amounts, as we said, of statistical information about fancied runners and riders and combinations, etc., ultimately sports enthusiasts were also interested in the people who were playing with the sport and playing the sports themselves. And undoubtedly, the emergence of prominent sporting figures on both local and national stages is facilitated by personality-driven sports. There we have an image of arguably the first major personality in the 19th century, W.G. Grace. Again, it helps with the personality that not only are you getting the emergence of photography, but you're also, in the case of Grace, getting somebody who's a very keen and successful cricketer. Prominent sporting heroes are actually difficult to find in the pages of the 19th century, with the conspicuous exception, as I've just noted, of the larger-than-life Gloucester cricketer, W.G. Grace. However, with increasing coverage of sport in the press and the rise of more informal means of reporting it, sporting characters have become much more known to newspaper readers, many of whom had not actually seen their sporting heroes in action, be that be England cricketer Jack Hobbs, or indeed Jackie Milburn from Newcastle United, or Jackie, as he's referred to. And cricketers such as the aforementioned England batsman Jack Hobbs became much-loved national figures, in part through press coverage. This is an era where press and print and radio, as we'll mention in a few moments, became part and parcel of the media convergence to construct national heroes and so on. Local players who would feature prominently in the pages of the local press would often be produced by ghosting sports column writers, professional writers, who would also help in terms of the construction of the image via advertising products and developing their own equivalents to Joe Hart advertising Head and Shoulders, for instance. And figures such as Jackie Milburn of Newcastle United from 1945 to 1957 was also celebrated in the local press as a classic local hero, a local lad who made good. Jackie had been born in Ashington. He'd worked down the pit as a coal miner. Other North East football also benefited from this working class hero scenario, including Raish Carter of Sunderland and Wilf Mannion of Middlesbrough. And indeed from Liverpool, Dixie Dean, advertising there and being presented in the very healthy Dixie Dean cigarette cards, presented with every packet of cigarettes that you might like to take to calm your nerves after watching your local team perform in the league. Indeed, perhaps the best example of this whole notion of a footballing local hero who didn't quite make it in terms of the national figure is Dixie Dean. A centre forward for Everton, he had an amazing season in which he scored more than 60 goals in the 1930s and again became very much a local hero. And somebody who, in an absence of television or indeed travelling to matches and so on, many people might not have been aware of, only through the image that we're presented and represented with of Dixie in the media. And reading of such sporting names and exploits also meant that it enhanced local pride. It also, perhaps more importantly, helps to define masculinity. If you're a young man who is a coal miner, who dreams of an escape, etc., Here are examples with Wilf Mannion, Raish Carter, Dixie Dean, of people who managed to escape into a world through basically playing sport. Sport as a route to success. Sport as a route to riches. All part and parcel of the cult of sports personality, which would develop even further with the emergence of broadcast sports journalism. Sorry about this, but it is David Beckham, and there we are.
No.
The BBC, British Broadcasting Company in 1922, British Broadcasting Corporation from 1927 onwards, played a crucial role in extending sports coverage. It played that role pretty much throughout the 20th century, in a pre-Sky Sports, Virgin Media era, and one which is with us to the present day. First of all, it played that role with its radio reporting. Latterly, in the latter half of the 20th century, it was its television coverage that really enhanced the whole notion of where the BBC related to sport and so on. From the 1920s, sport itself proved an immediate success at the BBC. Radio coverage of sport was actually one of the contributory factors which explained the rapid growth of radio. More and more people would actually buy radio sets simply to listen to the live coverage of the FA Cup final and other sporting events. Because if you're listening to the live commentary, that provides something as a broadcast journalist that you cannot get with respect to the print journalism, which is basically live immediacy, in other words, the sense of you actually being there and being present at the event. The number of radio licences effectively rose from 2 million to 8 million between 1926 and 1939. So far more people actually purchasing radio sets, not just for the sport, admittedly. There were other opportunities that were there, but it was undeniably a clear driving force in the success of how radio is being developed as a medium in itself. The first sports broadcast on the BBC was actually a 1922 boxing match. But John Reith, the BBC's first Director General, sought to give the whole notion of sport a national significance. He did this in part through two areas. First of all, through the selective coverage of a number of key sporting events, such as Test cricket, rugby internationals, the derby and the cup final, who all became established aspects of coverage on the BBC and established favourites within that. But also it was responsible for allowing a number of sporting events that previously had actually been classified as elite sports into national events. Good example of that being the annual Oxford to Cambridge boat race. This was hardly a national event before the BBC adopted it. And yet by 1939, 70% of the audience panel of a BBC survey actually listened to the boat race on an annual basis. Another sport, or rather occasion, that the BBC would actually popularise, and popularise very successfully, was Wimbledon, the Wimbledon Tennis Championships. Again, that had previously been seen at the best as a kind of bourgeois event in terms of its appeal. But the success of the working class northerner Fred Perry also helped popularise the sport and popularise the whole range of people who were listening to it and wanted to find out information about it. And undoubtedly, radio sports journalism would extend the already popular sports such as football to a wider public. The FA Cup final soon became the radio sports highlight of the year, and it also attracted a large female as well as a male audience. Writing in the Radio Times in 1930, the feminist novelist Winifred Holtby recalled listening to her first ever football commentary. It goes as follows. I was excited. I have not, to this day, the remotest notion of what they were doing. But I know now that I was excited. No one could listen with cold blood and sluggish pulses to the quickening crescendo of the roar preceding the final shout of goal. I wanted more goals. I didn't care who shot them. I didn't know who shot them. I didn't know what was playing, who was playing, or what they were playing, but I wanted to feel my spine tingle and my pulses beat as that voice cried out from somewhere near our drawing room curtains. Now he's got it. He's coming close on the right wing. I can't see for a moment because of the crowd. Oh, there it is. Now he's got it. He's got it. Goal! And so on and so forth. And you see a range of those kind of sporting commentaries manifested from other countries, Britain, etc. That sense of excitement that the commentary can actually provide and connect with the audience as live events are being developed. Even if you don't know anything about the game or the sporting event itself, you can still empathise with the heroes, the people who are actually there within the whole notion of broadcasting and sport. Now, the BBC's commentators tended in the main to be Oxbridge-educated broadcasters who were primarily folk who had an enthusiasm for sports rather than being true experts. Perhaps the most famous of these was John Snagg, you can still listen to on YouTube, he passed away a few years ago. Snagg actually commentated on the boat race from the 1930s into the 1980s. He was also closely followed by the football commentator George Allison. More kind of Barry Davis, John Modson, and so on would obviously echo the whole system. And arguably, the BBC's sports journalism helped raise the respectability of having an enthusiasm for popular sports such as football. There was still that sense that football was a game for gentlemen played by ruffians, whilst rugby was a game for ruffians played by gentlemen. And that kind of snobbishness, if you're in a middle-class household, middle-class environment, if you wanted to kind of encourage your parents to actually point out that actually football was okay, if you've got a middle-class commentator, or sounding middle-class, commentating on football matches, maybe there's sense that there is more of a sense of football as being a family occasion and so on. The writer Dave Russell, in a recent book called Football in the English, suggested that the increased interest shown in football by the quality press in the post-World War II years was as a direct consequence of football's enhanced position in the national culture. And that's in due almost solely to the radio coverage of the sport and the way in which radio would actually represent and package football, etc. The quality press would also nurture a new breed of football journalists whose more sober, reflecting writing style would contrast with the gossipy coverage in the more popular press. Journalists such as Geoffrey Green, who was the Times football correspondent from 1946 to 1976, and Brian Glanville and Hugh McIlvany, who are still writing today, would characterise this whole new style. And interestingly, the BBC also turns to such journalists for their expert comment on programmes such as Sports Report and so on. This more cerebral coverage of the sport, which was encouraged by BBC Radio, also raised the status of sport. It also raised the status of football in particular. And so we come to the sixth part of this little segment, Fever Pitch. Sports reporting in an extraterrestrial age of the sun and satellite television. Nick Hornby and Nick Coleman, noted that actually there were a range of more thoughtful, lengthier sports features written by, as I mentioned, Hugh McIlvany, which were very much the exception in Britain. They claimed that a country gets the sports journalism it deserves. And in America, both Hornby and Coleman argued that there are sports fans who effectively would focus on a range of sports, whereas in Britain there were football fans, there were cricket fans, there were rugby fans, fans of individual sports, not of all sports in general. That may be changing. But in America, it's not uncommon to find people who care about the New York Giants and the Yankees and the Rangers and so on. But in England, this cross-sport enthusiasm is generally regarded as rare. A lot of rugby fans would possibly kill for a ticket to Rugby Union England versus Scotland, but wouldn't cross the roads to watch Gloucester versus Leicester in rugby league. And again, in terms of that sporting culture aspect, we see a reflection in the sports writing. There's nothing still in Britain that compares with the monthly publication in America of Sports Illustrated, although folk have actually included that attempts by Robert Maxwell, the late Robert Maxwell, was doomed to failure in terms of trying to cover all sports, etc. And we still see, in terms of our sports coverage, a range of diverse sporting magazines rather than magazines which focus on a whole range of individual sports and so on. Also, this notion of the amount of time you've got to reflect on a piece. If you're restricted to column inches which say you need to focus everything down to 400 or 500 words, and almost do a critique, as opposed to a 3,000 or 4,000 word overall essay type piece, surely it actually limits what you can actually say about a particular topic or a sport and so on. And many of Britain's best sports journalists tended to have this notion of being chained to the treadmill of daily journalism. 800 word responses to yesterday's or today's sporting events. It's hard to transcend that sort of limitation and actually produce a piece that will endure as a piece of classic writing which focuses within sporting journalism and so on. Now that could be considered a rather harsh assessment, especially when you consider the rapid growth of the sports supplements or the sporting feature writers that has developed in the pages of the quality press from the 1980s onwards. The notion of the weekly supplements in the Times and the Telegraph relating to football obviously spring to mind. However, undoubtedly critics of late 20th century sports journalism have been attracted most by the sensationalist reports and the headlines in the red top tabloids. You again might grudgingly admire the inventiveness of many of the tabloid sports sub-editors. Celtic's ignominious defeat at the hands of Inverness Caledonian Thistle, of course, with the classic Super Cali go ballistic, Celtic are atrocious. But more populist sports coverage has also come in for much criticism, especially relating to the national team. Notoriously, the hapless Graham Taylor, when he was in charge of England, was likened to a turnip by the Sun when he was England's football manager as the team lost to Swedes in the early 1990s. The coverage of the European Championships in 1996 led to 300 complaints to the Press Complaints Commission relating to tabloid news items. And prior to England's semi-final match against Germany, the tabloids ran the following headlines: Achtung, surrender! And for you, Fritz, the Euro Championship is over. As well as in the Sun, let's blitz Fritz. The Daily Star, not to be outdone, here we go, bango the krauts. Now clearly that xenophobic, even racist tone does pervade such reports, despite the editor of the Daily Star at the time defending such jokes as good-natured, tongue-in-cheek and designed to raise a smile. It's perhaps ironic that this nationalistic little Englander mentality, as long as we beat the Scots 8-0 on Friday, I don't care, actually predominates in newspaper titles. These newspaper titles also, the irony being, are increasingly owned by multinational corporations, like Rupert Murdoch and the Sun, like Alexander Lebedev and the Independent and the I and so on. And that sport clearly has a crucial role to play in attracting new business. So again, there is a slight anomaly in terms of that. The relationship between sport and multimedia companies is also an increasingly complex one. Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation had been particularly alert to the significance sport could have in attracting customers, in attracting new customers in particular, to its Sky satellite television business. In 1992, Sky beat off a rival ITV offer for coverage of top-flight football matches by paying over £300 million for the privilege. Seems like a snip in these days where we're into billions of pounds, not just £300 million. But capturing sport, especially football, was central to Sky's business plan. That successful capture of football in terms of rights and broadcast rights and so on helped raise advertising revenues and also significantly increased subscription rates. If you wanted to be an armchair follower of your local team, your national team, etc., you needed to subscribe to the channel and so on, whether it was Sky 1, Sky 2, 3, etc., and all of the other concomitant areas that we've got within that. More recently, Sky and other media companies have sought to increase their control of the football clubs whose matches they transmit. There's the debate about when are matches scheduled for? Should they be on 12 o'clock at lunchtime? Should they be on a Friday night? What does that say for the gate receipt paying fans who are actually going to see their particular productions, etc.? And British Telecom obviously also recently have got successfully into the whole notion of purchasing large exclusive rights to broadcast live sporting events and so on. Sky also sought unsuccessfully to buy into Manchester United, but again settled for partial ownership of Leeds United, and again other clubs sort of expressed interest. They were talk about NTL taking out a stake in Newcastle United at one stage and so on. So again, this ownership of clubs is also pumping money into, in particular, football and so on. So what impact do those technological and business developments have upon television sports reporting, and what opportunities, moreover, do they provide for journalists in the 21st century? Well, whilst the sports coverage of the tabloid press appears to be primarily still dumbing down, the increasing amount of airtime given over to television sports coverage seems to have deepened the examination of sports. Live coverage of sport, especially football, has extended considerably over the last decade as a consequence of satellite and digital television. Sports coverage of the terrestrial channels has necessarily altered in terms of the format, in terms of the approach it's taken, largely because television rights to many sports have been lost. And the BBC's domination of sport, which is what we took for granted for pretty much 60 or 70 years in the 20th century, that's effectively been eroded. It's often, in many ways, become a distant memory, where the BBC's sort of gold standard of covering all of the major sporting events has either been lost to satellite companies and so on, whether it be golf, whether it be Formula One and so on. This notion of the whole notion of the BBC indeed having to shift its line to maybe even featuring tiddlywinks as a sport has actually changed and adjusted and so on. And instead of live sport, both ITV and the BBC have turned their attention to sports magazine programmes. Five Live does this as well, Channel 5, offering in-depth previews of games or match days and extensive results services. So they've adjusted their approach accordingly. This explosion of television coverage of sports has also inevitably brought with it great opportunities for sports journalists, many of whom have switched media from print to television or broadcasting journalism, broadcast journalism areas. Publicity and quality sports journalists such as Patrick Barkley are often presented as pundits on stations like TalkSport, Five Live and others, alongside recently retired sportsmen and women, many of whom have also started consciously developing media presentation skills while still actually playing the sport themselves. You have this growth not of the professional enthusiast commentating, but of the ex-professional who's played the game, suddenly developing their broadcasting skills to commentate on the matches and games and so on. Finally, it's worthwhile considering the whole notion of how the fan is positioned in this whole basis. Because at the end of the day, it's where it all started. If it wasn't for sports fans paying their gate receipt money, we wouldn't have even started off this whole launch of commercial sport and the development within that. So let's consider some sort of key points to sort of wrap up this whole particular sequence, which again referenced the whole notion of both Benson's Rise of Consumer Society and indeed Coleman and Hornby's Picador Book of Sports Writing and Holt's, Richard Holt's, Sport and the British. In the early years of the 20th century, as we said, sports results featured increasingly in the press. As technology evolved, these were printed almost immediately, or certainly pretty much as soon as the game had actually finished, within half an hour to an hour, etc. And there was a clear demand for such information, especially from the vast number of gamblers who were actually taking part in Britain at the time. Secondly, the coming of radio sports journalism arguably extended the reach of sport into many middle-class homes. This had an impact especially upon the coverage of popular sports such as football and in the pages of the quality press that primarily had focused upon sports such as rugby union and cricket. So you're getting a shift in class consciousness as well. Thirdly, in the age of the red top tabloid, especially from the 1970s onwards, coverage of international sporting fixtures by popular journalists would often descend into xenophobic, jingoistic, and almost racist headlines. Fourthly, in contrast, the extension of television technology into the satellite and digital age brought about more in-depth and imaginative sports reporting. And finally, as sports and sports reporting have become more corporate with the influx of satellite television money and the involvement of public relations people and so on, this has also prompted a bit of a backlash amongst genuine sports fans who feel that their voices are being excluded from the whole game that they actually follow. In the case of football, the Football Supporters Association was set up in 1985, and the voice of the fanzine began to appear in a range of cheaply produced fan magazines, many of which have actually gone online now. There's still some that sort of exist, Fly Me to the Moon being one of them with respect to Middlesbrough and so on. But again, for many who wish to pursue a career in writing as sports journalists, the opportunity to have their work published in the local fanzine for their local club and so on actually provided the first steps in not only actually putting some commentary down on paper, but also reflecting upon the way and the styles in which the actual their love developed and was seen as working. So that, ladies and gentlemen, kind of brings us to the end of the sport and sporting journalism symbiotic relationship, which will echo again in terms of seminars. Suffice to say, next week, we're into magazines in a big way with Hearth and Home. Thanks for your time, and see you at all.